From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review the latest version of Jack London's classic, The Call of the Wild, starring Harrison Ford. Another literary adaptation arrives in Jane Austen's Emma, starring Anya Taylor-Joy. The complicated life of French New Wave actress Jean Seberg is told in a new biopic starring Kristen Stewart. This week also brings promising documentaries and a conversation on the most potent documentaries in history. Right now, we're listening to Philip Glass's score for Errol Morris's acclaimed documentary, The Thin Blue Line. It's Film Week right after the news here on 89.3 KPCC. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us, along with critics Christy Lemire for RogerEbert.com and co-host of Breakfast All Day, the podcast. Also with us, Leah Lowenstein, who film columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press. Well, we begin with The Call of the Wild, the latest film adaptation of the Jack London classic about the sled dog Buck struggling for survival. Harrison Ford stars in the lead human role as outdoorsman John Thornton.
This is a map of the Yukon. My son was always reading adventure stories. He's crazy about the news coming out of the Yukon. It wasn't the gold, he didn't care about that, it was the mountains. He spent all day looking at maps and pictures of the mountains, dreaming about what was on the other side. Places no one had been. Wild places. We could go.
That's Harrison Ford starring in The Call of the Wild, directed by Chris Sanders. Michael Green did the adaptation of Jack London's novel. Christy, what did you think?
This is a very strange hodgepodge of stuff going on here, and it occupies a very uncomfortable middle ground in terms of the ideal audience that it's for. I brought my son, who is 10 years old, and he's perfect for it, because if you're too young, you're going to be freaked out by how intense and scary it is. If you're much older, you're going to think it's really overly simplistic, and the anthropomorphism going on here is really cloying and overbearing and too sickly sweet. But the images are beautiful. It's The Call of the Wild. You know, there's gorgeous, you know, vistas. Janusz Kaminski, who is Steven Spielberg's usual cinematographer, shot this. It's very beautiful. It's got a great cast. Harrison Ford, Omar Sy, Bradley Whitford, a very villainous Dan Stevens, like over-the-top mustache-twirling Dan Stevens. You know, it's got some thrilling moments, but it's got way too many cheesy moments of assigning human characteristics to the dog that I don't recall being to that extent in the book. Do you, Leo?
No, not at all. And I think for me, that was the problem with this adaptation, was that I was sort of taken out of the movie a few times by the CG enhanced dog, which was a motion capture performance originally by this guy, Terry Notary, sort of in the way that Andy Serkis has done Planet of the Apes and King Kong and so forth. But several times I was thinking, I don't think a dog would move exactly this way, or that, you know, this is a gesture that doesn't seem completely dog-like to me. So it was trying to, like you said, to skirt that you know, the middle ground of make it comfortable, make it delightful for the kids. And there was a fair dose of comedy that didn't seem necessarily appropriate or endemic to the book, with a fair amount of darkness and violence, which the book does cover some of that. But, you know, there's dog fighting. There's the implication of abuse of dogs. There's exhausting sequences where the dogs are running through, mushing through the snow and onto ice floes and through tunnels, avoiding avalanches and so forth. I thought the best parts were actually when Harrison Ford and Buck, the dog, are bonding together. I thought that was very sweet, if perhaps a little cloying and a little bit Not entirely realistic.
Yeah, the dog seems to really understand Harrison Ford on a deep molecular level, to the extent that, like, he's giving him a judgy kind of, like, eyebrow and a sigh when Harrison Ford drinks too much again.
Takes the bottle away.
Right. Yeah. The dog is super smart. And again, that stuff seems like it's for kids, right? The dog being that capable in a funny way seems like it's for kids. But then that ability is used for serious stuff. Like Harrison Ford's alcoholism.
Right. And dog, to me, I think that the movies with and about dogs sort of fall into two different groups. There's the ones where there's the real dogs, the Lassies, the Marley and Me, the Old Yeller. And then there's the CG, you know, Truth About Cats and Dogs or the Beethovens and things where dogs do things that they wouldn't really necessarily do in real life. The dogs are sort of human-like. And to me, I wish that this film had aired more on the side of, you know, having the dog, like, just use real dogs. Like, right? Like, what's wrong? Like, give a dog a job. I mean, I don't know. Like,
The Call of the Wild is in wide release. It's rated PG-13. Standing Up, Falling Down, comedic drama starring Billy Crystal and Ben Schwartz. Matt Ratner is the director. Peter Hoare is the screenwriter of the film. Leo, what'd you think?
I love this movie, and I thank Christy for making sure I saw it. It was a surprise, the surprise and the delight of the week. And it's not just a buddy movie. It's a story about two people coming together who are kind of rueful and wistful and both feeling pain and loss at a certain point in their lives. Ben Schwartz plays a failed comedian who moves from California back home to the East Coast and runs into Billy Crystal, a dermatologist who starts off as a real kind of jerk to him, but they become buddies through this movie. And through the course of their friendship, there's delightful banter. There's really great sort of witty dialogue. And I loved seeing Billy Crystal having a chance to really kind of act again. Like, it feels like the last few things I've seen him in, which there haven't been that many, he was sort of more slapsticky. And this was just Parental Guidance is the movie that I'm thinking of. This was just a lovely performance, and so it felt so lived in. Great supporting cast also, Grace Gummer, Deborah Monk as well. Just I really, really enjoyed the performances. I loved the lived in feeling of it. I loved that the friendship felt authentic.
Yeah, I liked this very much too, and I was surprised because off the bat, it looks and feels like pure formula, mm-hmm. right? And who these two guys are, like, they fit into one another's lives so perfectly, mm-hmm. although on paper, it would make absolutely no sense for them to be friends. So Ben Schwartz, you know, he's a failed comedian. He's not close to his own father. Mm-hmm. And he finds in Billy Crystal a father figure. Mm-hmm. Billy Crystal is not close to his own son, who's mm-hmm. about Ben Schwartz's age. And so, like, that is, it seems too tidy.
Right.
But the dialogue is so snappy. They have such terrific chemistry with each other that you want to spend time with them. And it is all in this small town, but they find every place to go and every facet of the small town to explore together. And their friendship becomes so sweet. And it's great to see, as you see, Billy Crystal getting to dig in dramatically again. He does it so infrequently, but it's so lovely and it feels so genuine and effective. And yeah, they're great. Also, you have the voices of Sonic the Hedgehog and Mikey from the Monsters, Inc. movies
That's
together,
right.
which is kind of cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're great together. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising given what you're saying about the film. It's only in one theater. It's just playing at the Monica Film Center.
Sometimes it just takes a recommendation from, you know.
Yeah, from two esteemed critics to turn the tide on it.
It's our job. That's why we're here.
I do hope people will see it because, you know, it's like you said, Christy, it seems formulaic, but once you get into it, it's so much more than that. It really is delightful.
And it sounds like from what you're describing is sort of everything had to align. You had to have the screenplay mm-hmm. with the witty, sort of believable repartee, even if the setup wouldn't in the real world happen. The dialogue has to be believable.
Yeah.
And the actors then carrying that out and having that kind of intangible, that chemistry.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it is very funny and very self-aware about these sad sack guys and their lives, but the possibility of redemption also feels very real and not cheesy.
That's right.
Standing Up, Falling Down, comedic drama, Lemley's Monica Film Center, it's unrated. The latest film version of Jane Austen's Emma stars Anya Taylor-Joy, Autumn DeWilde, the director, and Eleanor Catton adapted the book. Christy?
So the best compliment I will give this is that it reminded me of Little Women, of this most recent Greta Gerwig version of Little Women, you know, a book we have seen so many versions of. Here is yet another version of Emma. You know, Gwyneth Paltrow played her in the 90s, and then Clueless is a version of Emma with Alicia Silverstone. And so now Anya Taylor-Joy is playing this very famous Jane Austen character. And it reminds me of Little Women in that it is rooted in the historical context of the novel, the beloved novel and the setting, but it feels so alive and fresh and new and like you've never seen it before. And that has to do with the energy of the performances. It has to do with the costume design, which is just totally inspired. Like, it's, again, it's period costume design, but there's maybe something a little different going on with the dresses or with the hair or with the hats that just kind of takes you out of that lull of that comfort zone and makes you rethink what you're watching here. So Anya Taylor-Joy is Emma, and she's rich and bored and meddling in everybody else's affairs in this small English town, and carelessly so, and just does not care about, you know, how she might potentially hurt people. She can be very capricious and very hurtful, but also just a snoopy, nosy busybody. And there's one guy in town who has her number, you know, who has known her whole life and won't let her get away with what she's trying to pull. And they have tremendous chemistry with each other. It is, I'm going to forget it, Johnny Flynn. He's amazing in this. Like, he's playing David Bowie in an upcoming film. And he's gorgeous. And they have great, sexy, fun, flirty chemistry with each other. Bill Nye plays her dad. And just like watching Bill Nye like walk into a room and be annoyed by everything is good for a laugh every time. So I was really delighted. If you think, ugh, this is going to be a stuffy adaptation of a book I read in high school, it's not. It's lovely.
And Emma, of course, has been adapted multiple times before with Gwyneth Paltrow in, mm-hmm. I think, about 93, yeah. And then most notably as Clueless.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a great adaptation.
Right, which really was, yeah. And modernized right. It.
Setting the Beverly nice. Hills edition of
yes,
Clueless.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So if you have not seen those, check out Emma. It's really quite lovely and funny.
Emma, this new version, Anya Taylor-Joy stars, Autumn DeWilde directed, it's rated PG, and you can see it at the Arclight Cinemas in Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. The horror film Brahms, The Boy 2 did not screen for critics this week. It stars Katie Holmes. Premature, a romantic drama, stars Zora Howard and Joshua Boone. It's directed by Rashad Ernesto Green, who co-wrote the screenplay with the star Zora Howard. Lael?
I really enjoyed this film. It's a raw, edgy teen romance, an African-American romance that feels fresh and alive. It's set against the backdrop of songwriting and music in Harlem. And this young couple, Zora Howard and Joshua Boone, fall in love, and she is sort of pulled into this relationship against her, you know, initial resistance towards this guy Isaiah, and the way the scenes are shot felt so fresh, so real, and so full of life. And same with the dialogue, which I think Zora Howard as well wrote. Yes, mm-hmm. she was the co-writer on it, and she interestingly plays a girl who's a writer in the film, and when Isaiah, her boyfriend, discovers her potential for songwriting lyrics, he tries to encourage her, and she's got a whole lot of reticence about that as well. So it's sort of about her coming into her own. The dialogue among Zora and her friends felt absolutely completely authentic, as did the performance by her mother. I agree.
Yeah, the times where she's just hanging out with her girlfriends are hilarious. And you feel like you are just a fly on the wall for an absolutely authentic moment, whether they're, you know, because they're like 17-year-old girls and they're getting ready to go out for the night or just, you know, hanging out at the park with each other or hanging out in the subway. It feels so real. This was a nominee for the Independent Spirit Award for the Cassavetes Award, which is for films made for $500,000 and under. It also won one of their Someone to Watch awards for the director, Rashad Ernesto Green. And it truly is an independent film in the all the best possible ways, in the authenticity of it, in the sense of place, in the fact that you feel like you are truly watching real people figuring out their lives. We were talking earlier about how standing up, falling down feels like a bit of a formula. This mm-hmm. might also have felt like a bit of a formula in that you have a 17-year-old girl getting involved with a much older guy. I mean, he's like, what, late, maybe he's 30?
I don't think he's quite that old, but he's 20-something. He's significantly older than she is.
Yeah. And as a friend say, he's grown.
Right.
Right? And she's not. And so that might seem to suggest a perilous path that she's going down, but it defies all those expectations that you might have for this kind of romance.
And even though there's some tropes that we've seen before and some moments that I feel like we've seen in these coming of age movies, it's handled in a very fresh and original way, I thought.
The film is Premature, starring Zora Howard and Joshua Boone, directed by Rashad Ernesto Green, who co-wrote the screenplay with Zora Howard. The film's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica, Lemley's NoHo North Hollywood, and Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena. Coming up, we're going to talk about the film inspired by a segment in the life of actress Jean Seberg, the film titled Seberg, starring Kristen Stewart. That's coming up. And we got a couple of documentaries this week we'll hear about, including The Times of Bill Cunningham, which includes a long interview back from 1994 with the street photographer and fashion historian. It chronicles his four decades at the New York Times. And we'll talk about documentary filmmaking. We'll hear from listeners and our critics what they think are some of the most important documentaries of film and television ever presented. Back in a minute. On election night, Tuesday, March 2nd, Libby Denkman and I will be bringing you live coverage of the returns, along with NPR's coverage of the other big states as part of Super Tuesday. A third of the total Democratic delegates are at stake. We'll be talking about the Democratic primaries here in California and across the country. That's Tuesday night, March 2nd, election night, right here on KPCC. Also want to let you know, coming up Saturday afternoon, 2 to 4 o'clock, which means for those of you listening to the Saturday Film Week broadcast, coming up very soon, it's NPR's live coverage of the Nevada caucuses. So that's coming up, 2 hours of coverage, 2 to 4, Saturday afternoon, right here on 89.3 KPCC. I'm with critics Leo Lowenstein and Christy Lemire. Our next film up is Seberg, inspired by Jean Seberg, the actress who was targeted by the FBI in the late 60s. Kristen Stewart stars in the film. Benedict Andrews directs. Joe Shrapnel and Anna Waterhouse are the screenwriters. Christy.
So the approach here is one that I quite frequently like in telling the story of a famous person's life. You know, not trying to go from cradle to grave, taking one pivotal segment of this person's life and trying to understand who they are and how they've evolved or how they became significant culturally because of it. And that would theoretically seem to have been the case here with Seberg, because it's about Jean Seberg's political activism, about her feeling understandably outraged by the treatment of African Americans in the United States in the 1960s, and she gets really involved with the Black Panther Party and to the detriment of her career. And once she starts, you know, donating money and holding fundraisers and just being using her celebrity to be a visible force for this movement, it takes a toll, and she becomes threatened and targeted by the FBI, and there's massive surveillance that goes on. Jack O'Connell and Vince Vaughn are two of the FBI agents who are watching her and are after her. But everything about this is so superficial, and the dialogue spells out absolutely everything. Having said that, I never felt like I truly understood what drove her. I mean, Kristen Stewart is great in everything, but I never understood why she felt compelled to put her life in jeopardy, to put her career in jeopardy for this cause. I mean, she talks about it in these kind of easy platitudes, but I never really believed her. I want to give a shout out, though, to the costume designer, Michael Wilkinson, because everything Kristen Stewart wears is perfect. So sexy, sleek, 60s mod style. She's got the pixie blonde haircut. She looks the part, and the production design too. Mm. That house she lives in here in California. Oh my God, I wanted to move in tomorrow.
was part of this also is because she had a romantic relationship with one of the Black Panthers,
right. Played by
she?
Anthony Mackie.
Yeah.
Right.
Leah, what do you think?
Well, I saw the movie a few weeks ago, and what I remember most are the costumes and the production design, so that'll tell you something. First of all, Kristen Stewart is the perfect choice just in terms of casting. She is beloved by the French. She's won one or two César Awards. She speaks French, and so in that sense, she's the perfect person to play Jean Seberg, who was so beloved by the French and, of course, cast so memorably in Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless, as well as playing Joan of Arc and being literally burnt by Otto Preminger, suffering for her craft. So I felt that really it didn't go anywhere into her psyche. It didn't sort of, like you said, Christy, you know, an excess of platitudes, the dialogue being essentially flat and not really showing much about Jean Seberg or who she was as a real person.
And there's kind of a vaguely interesting idea with Jack O'Connell as the FBI agent becoming fascinated by mm-hmm. her that they sort of skim the surface of and don't ever delve into
deeper. They
were
afraid to go deeper, yeah.
Seberg opened before the end of the year in an Academy qualifying run. It's now in additional theaters. Seberg's rated R at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. The documentary, The Times of Bill Cunningham, tells about the career of the street photographer and fashion historian. Four decades of work at the New York Times. Lael?
This is a good documentary. It's not as good as Bill Cunningham's New York, which came out about 10 years ago, Christine?
2011, yeah.
2011, which was a really fascinating and comprehensive look at Bill Cunningham with a lot of input from people who knew him. He was, of course, the legendary street photographer who was known for filling up two pages in the Sunday New York Times every week with these amazing pictures of people, ordinary people wearing things that he found fashionable, which were fashionable. He had an incredible eye. He would rove the streets on his bicycle with his camera. He lived a minimalist lifestyle. He was known for his blue sanitation worker's jacket that was part of his uniform. What's different about this one, as opposed to that one, is this is Bill Cunningham himself on screen for most of the time talking about himself. And as someone who was, frankly, somewhat self-effacing and didn't really like talking about himself that much, it creates an interesting sort of dilemma. It's like, you know, he's really not that comfortable even giving any sort of perspective on himself. But I found it also fascinating as a particular document of someone of that vintage, particularly the moments where he becomes emotional reluctantly and his voice cracks and sort of they choose to stop the camera rolling for
and
that.
And this
purpose.
Was all recorded back in 1994.
Yeah, he supposedly sat down for a 10-minute interview and was there for 6 hours.
Wow.
So not unlike Seberg, this is also about great clothes and it's mm-hmm. also frustratingly superficial.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, he is effervescent. And when he's talking about what he loves, whether it's, you know, making hats, which is how he got his start.
Yeah, he was a milliner.
Yeah. Or, you know, the celebrities and the socialites that he dressed. And everyone's marvelous and charming. He still has that Boston accent after so many years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he's talking about the things he loves, you know, truly inspired street style and putting it together from a place of pure creativity versus like having a stylist tell you how to dress,
mm-hmm.
that he lights up and that's great. But this movie never even begins to dare to get to know him better. And there are mm-hmm. a couple of openings for that. There are a couple, as you mentioned, Lael, a couple of opportunities where he gets choked up talking about friends who died of AIDS.
For example, yes.
For example. Or he gets choked up talking about how innately shy he mm-hmm. truly is and is quite nervous going out on the street, and his voice will catch and he'll drop his head. And the gentleman, the director who is interviewing him, is like, "It's okay, Bill, you don't have to go on." And he wants to make him feel comfortable, but it's to the detriment, and that's a kind gesture, but
it's
to the detriment of the storytelling.
And to our detriment watching it, because we really want to see him push through that and see what, you know, where he's going to go with that.
Yeah. And we don't talk about his personal life at all.
Yeah,
and
no,
that,
not at all.
I would like to have at least dipped a toe somewhere into that.
Which seems to be a kind of respectful gesture to keep a distance there. But the other film, I think, did actually cover that somewhat. Yeah, it was, I actually, you know, I don't think this is as bad as some people think it is. I think it's an interesting complement to the other one.
Mm. The Times of Bill Cunningham from director Mark Bozick. It's unrated. You can see it at the Arclight in Hollywood and at several of the Lemley's theaters, including the Royal, the Playhouse, and the Town Center in the San Fernando Valley. The Woman Who Loves Giraffes, also a documentary this week about Ann Innes Dagg. The film's directed by Allison Reed. Lael.
This is about one of the most impressive scientists you've never heard of. Ann Innes Dagg is still around. She's a she was the first woman and one of the first scientists to study a single species. She went to Africa 4 years before Jane Goodall went to study primates.
This is 65 years ago.
Yeah,
she went.
It's pretty amazing. And actually, to hear her talk about how she originally became enamored of giraffes. She was 3 years old. She was taken to the Brookfield Zoo. She said, "This is what I want to do with my life. I want to study these creatures." And then she found when she was in her 20s and applied to go to Africa to study and to write about them, to learn about them, that the answer that she got over and over, including from Louis Leakey, was, well, it wouldn't be appropriate for a woman, you know, to do this. It's just, you know, we have accommodations for men, for example, but not for women. So she learned to rewrite her letter of application just with the initial A. Innes. And by the way, as a little back note, her eventual husband had proposed to her and said, you know, instead of going to Africa, why don't we just get married? This was her life's dream. And she said, no, I'm going to Africa. We'll get married when I get back. And this was the kind of thing she ran into over and over again. So she did get accepted to go to Africa to do this inquiry into giraffes. Disguising herself as a man. When she got there, she had to drive for several hours, including after her car broke down. She had to walk alone on a road, wondering if she was going to get eaten by a lion. You know, I mean, this was an incredibly intrepid woman who did a lot and pioneered the field of giraffe research. She actually wrote the definitive book called, I think it's called The Giraffe, which was used for years and years by anyone studying the field.
How long before we get a biopic about her?
Right. Well, this is the thing. And I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, because I think Ann Innes Dagg's story is remarkable. She also ran into a tenure issue at the university in Canada where she was teaching, and she wanted very much to be a teacher, but was told in not so many words that a woman like you is not going to get tenure. You're not, you know, it was an old boys club and so forth. So the problem with the film is there's too much B-roll. There's not enough, you know, there's not enough sort of actual original footage. There's some, and much of what you see is fascinating, but it needs a little bit of filler, and I think it needs to be sort of reconfigured, and hopefully somebody will do it as a biopic, because she's got an amazing story, and she's a really inspirational woman.
Allison Reed is the director of The Woman Who Loves Giraffes. It's unrated. It's at several of the Lemley's theaters. Goldie, a drama starring Slick Woods, directed by Sam DeYoung. Christy?
Slick Woods is this model, sort of Instagram model, who's done some work with Rihanna. Apparently Kanye West discovered her, and she's got this really unusual and really distinctive look about her. She has this shaved head, and she's got a gap between her teeth, and she's like 5'11". She's just statuesque and stunning, and there's no one who looks like her. She's got this really striking presence, which is a lot of what drives this film and how compelling it is. And we were talking earlier about Premature and how indie that is. This is like indier than indie. This feels very scrappy and very much like you're on the streets with these people, and it's all being shot on the fly, for better and for worse. And she plays a teenager who has these dreams of hip-hop video stardom. And she feels like if she can just get the money together to buy this really plush, fluffy, yellow fur coat, then she can be in this hip-hop video and she can finally be the star that she knows she was always destined to become. But the reality of her life is that she lives in a family shelter with her mom, who is or has been a drug addict, and the mom's boyfriend, who is a dealer, and her two much younger sisters. And they're all about to get kicked out. And so she's got to scramble over the course of a couple of days on the streets of New York to figure out a place to live. And also figure out how to get the money, because this video shoot is coming up and she feels like, if I can just get to that, then I can make everything better for myself and my family. It's going to be okay. And she's got just tremendous natural swagger and bravado. And she's funny and she's streetwise and she thinks on her feet really, really well. But you know, she can't keep all the plates spinning. She's going from one person to the next and asking, can you watch my little sisters for like an hour or two? And you truly do feel like you are along with these people for what is kind of a harrowing ride. But then there's like these flights of fancy, these kind of animated interludes that show the possible lightness and joy of her inner life. And it's a really daring and ambitious and scrappy attempt here at an indie comedy drama, and I liked it.
Goldies, the film, written and directed by Sam DeYoung, Slick Wood stars. It's unrated at the Music Hall in Beverly Hills. We have just a minute or so for the documentary Once We're Brothers, which tells the story of Robbie Robertson of the band, his young life, and the creation of the rock group. Lael?
Yes, whether or not you've seen the iconic documentary The Last Waltz, you've probably heard about it.
Martin Scorsese directed
a documentary from 78, which documented the last performance of the band. This is interesting. 40 years later, having Robbie Robertson, the founder of the band, look back with some, not so much regret, but with a sort of wistfulness, and talk about, you know, what made his band so great, what it was about the confluence of these personalities, and then what made them come apart. There's a sadness to it in that he's one of only two surviving members of the band. I would have loved to see, Garth, for instance, interviewed, but...
Yeah, they don't even mention why it is that he does not speak. I was never a big fan of the band, and this film did not necessarily make me one, but I appreciated learning more about the mythology. Having said that, this kind of repetitious nature to everyone saying they were brothers.
Right.
It was a miracle. But the talking heads like Bruce Springsteen, Scorsese, George Harrison, Eric mm-hmm. Clapton, and a wealth of archival footage.
Yep.
Once We're Brothers, the documentary's rated R at the ArcLight Hollywood, the Landmark in West L.A., Daniel Rohr. The director, also for fans of The Color Purple, Sunday, one day only, screening in selected theaters in Southern California. We'll talk about documentaries next.
They are the migrants, workers in the sweatshops of the soil, the harvest of shame. Brought to you tonight by Philip Morris Incorporated, makers of Marlboro, filter cigarette with the unfiltered...
CBS News classic documentary, Harvest of Shame. If you're a baby boomer like me, there's a good chance you saw this in your school classroom long after it aired on CBS stations in 1960. Hugely influential to see what was going on in an agricultural America. But it's just one example of the power of a documentary to significantly affect American public opinion and to bring to light issues of great concern. In John Wilkman's new book, Screening Reality, he looks at how documentary filmmakers have reimagined America. He himself is a documentarian, first with CBS News, also with KCET locally here in Los Angeles for many years, with television documentaries and with feature films. John Wilkman, great to have you with us again on Film Week.
Hi, Larry. Nice to see you again, too.
So you really get at the issue here of the power of documentaries, but let's start first with the ones that, when you were coming up, were most influential.
Well, as you said, I started my career at CBS News on a series called The 20th Century with Walter Cronkite. And it was about history. And that really encouraged me to get interested in history and in historical documentaries. And by that time, and certainly by the 60s, and even with Harvest of Shame and Murrow and Friendly, it became very clear in an advertiser-driven environment that in-depth documentaries and cultural programmings really were an endangered species on commercial television networks. And so the power of those films was even greater because they stood out from the rest of the broadcasts, which are basically was I Love Lucy and Ed Sullivan and all those shows that were hugely popular. But they reached, Murrow and Friendly reached people in a way that it's hard to imagine today when there are only three networks. They really reached a lot of America.
Millions and millions of people. And a cross-cultural section of America that's difficult to replicate in this era of theatrical documentaries and even streaming series. I think it's tough because there you were able to hit everything from the wealthiest to working class and impoverished families.
Well, also, I think that the kind of documentaries that were done in those days, they're considered sort of old-fashioned to some extent. Murrow and Friendly were radio guys for the most part. David Lowe, who was the producer of Harvest of Shame, he was the guy who was really responsible for a lot of it. But basically, it was kind of a journalism that nowadays is considered out of fashion, but it was really important, and that's why one of the reasons I wrote the book is that the idea of documentaries as based on evidential truth is really important. And the early Murrow-Friendly things were like legal briefs. They assembled information. Yeah. They laid it out for you. They argued for a case in, I think, a fair and honest way. And Harvest of Shame, interestingly enough, they aired it 2 days after, or I guess it was a day after Thanksgiving. And so that was pretty bold stuff.
Yes.
And Bill Paley, who ran CBS at the day, would say to Murrow, I just don't want you to keep doing this and giving me stomach upset every time you do.
Especially after Thanksgiving. We're talking with John Wilkman, himself a documentarian, and his work has appeared on just about every major network. He did a 7-part Turner Classic movie series, Moguls and Movie Stars, A History of Hollywood, nominated for 3 Emmys, and has also written books about history here in Southern California. He's been with us several times on Air Talk, and for 3 terms, he was the president of the International Documentary Association. His new book, Screening Reality, How Documentary Filmmakers Reimagined America. But here's what I'd like from you as a Film Week listener. I'd like to hear from you if there's a particular documentary which was really breakthrough for you, which helped you see something in an entirely different way and really change. It could be your politics. It could be the way you live your life. It could be how you thought about certain groups of people or certain occupations. 866-893-KPECC. If you're listening to the live Friday broadcast of Film Week, it's a chance for you to take part by calling us at 866-893-5722. If you're listening on Saturday, you can still comment on our Film Week page at kpecc.org and share with your fellow listeners which documentary film really for you was a huge factor in you changing your thought or your behavior about something. Our Film Week critics also continue with us. Christy Lemire, Leo Lowenstein. Leo, for you, do you have a doc or two that really hit you like a ton of bricks?
I have many. The couple that come to mind just sort of most recently, last year, I guess it was the year before, I loved the film Minding the Gap, which is ostensibly about skateboarding, but it's really much more about toxic masculinity in the Rust Belt and coming of age movie for these young men. Also really liked OJ Made in America, the many hour documentary and document of what was going on culturally around the time of the OJ incident. Free Solo last year was so terrific and gripping. And then going back, much, much further, back to the late 80s, I loved when Thin Blue Line, Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line, and Michael Moore's Roger and Me sort of started making the documentary kind of sexy and accessible for everybody. So many good ones, but yeah.
You mentioned Minding the Gap, so let's go back a couple of years to this critic's favorite. First-time director Bing Lo, who turned his video camera on himself and his group of skateboarding friends.
To other people, it's funny, haha, these guys are crazy. But in reality, I think it's a control thing. You have to control the most minute, small details to make you feel normal in a world that's not normal.
It would kind of be like a drug in a way.
Like
I could seriously be on the verge of having a fucking mental breakdown. But as long as I'm able to go skate, then I'm completely fine.
All right, my apologies for the language in that clip that we missed on our edit of that. Christy, favorite for you?
So, Stories We Tell by Sarah Polley is a movie I talk about all the time. And she went back and she interviewed her family and asked each of them, tell me the story of our family as if you are telling it for the first time. And it's this fascinating exploration of what's a real memory. What's something that you saw in a photograph that you have just conflated with an experience that you know? And what's a story that you have been told so many times that you have just ingested it into your life as lore? Mm-hmm. And I refer to that, and I think about that all the time. Lael mentioned Minding the Gap, which is great. We are both in the LA Film Critics Association, and we tend to give our best editing award for the past few years to documentaries, whether it's O.J. Made in America or Apollo 11 last year. We have, I think, a great appreciation for the great craft and the time it takes, as you know, being a documentarian yourself, sir, putting it all together and making it cohesive and making it flow and not seem overwhelming.
Well, one of the things both of you, referring to both of your films that you liked, women play a big role in this film, mm-hmm. I mean, in this book, and as editors, but also as collaborative creative partners, going all the way back to the famous Robert Flaherty, who did Nanook of the North, and his wife, Frances. And one of the great stories that I tell is that in Hollywood, women were in the early days were very powerful as writers, directors, and producers. They got pushed away in the 30s. Many of them found a home in documentaries and nonfiction films. But they were, for example, the Maisels. Everyone talks about the Maisels brothers, Grey Gardens, all you know, Salesman, Gimme Shelter. Really behind these films is a woman, Charlotte Swearin, who was an editor. And the story on Salesman, which is their first big film about traveling salesmen, the Maisels, like a lot of cinema verite documentarians, shot hundreds of hours of films and they just dumped it on the editor's desk. And, you know, let's make a movie out of this. I'm exaggerating, but it's close, it's close to true. And Charlotte Swearin did make a movie out of it, and many times for him. And at that point she said, you know, I was the editor here, but I should be co-director. And the Maisels said no.
Oh.
She fought. She got the co-director credit, and other documentary editors have become more and more creative partners.
We'll continue with John Wilkman, himself a documentarian, three-term president of the International Documentary Association, and author of the new book, Screening Reality, How Documentary Filmmakers Reimagined America. We'll continue with John, as well as our critics, back in 1 minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the most powerful documentaries, either of film or television. We're talking with John Wilkman, whose new book is Screening Reality, and our Film Week critics, Christy and Lael, with us as well for Friday Live Film Week listeners. Chance for you to join us. Your most powerful documentary that really made you rethink something or change your behavior. 866-893-KPCC. Saturday Film Week listeners, you can contribute on the Film Week page at kpcc.org. Free Solo, the documentary chosen the best by the Academy in 2018, followed American rock climber Alex Honnold's attempt to become the first person to free solo climb Yosemite's El Capitan. In this clip, Alex's support team goes over safety protocols the day before the climb.
The easiest thing would just be 911, and that wheel will get kicked into gear and tell them what you know.
A climber.
Yeah.
All right. No mistakes tomorrow. Worried that tomorrow's gonna be it. Like, you know, like Alex's existence will be over. I was like, oh, I have to be prepared for that outcome, and I have to realize that that is a real possibility.
Free Solo, directed by Elizabeth Shai Vassarelli and Jimmy Chin. Again, that was the best Oscar winner of 2018. Let's talk with our Film Week listeners. Deborah in Mar Vista, what documentary film hit you with full force?
Oh, gosh, Game Changers. I saw Game Changers right after, like, during Thanksgiving weekend when I was with a lot of people who were really excited about Thanksgiving dinner. And it's all about having, you know, living in a vegan...
Deborah, I'm sorry, the audio quality is so bad from your call, but that I understand that it changed the way you looked at food and you became vegan as a result of that film. Thank you very much. Aaron, in West Los Angeles, what film hit you hard and changed how you lived?
Super Size Me, watching Morgan Spurlock get all unhealthy, made me want to eat better.
So you gave up fast food after Super Size Me?
I didn't totally give it up, but I don't eat as much as I used to.
All right, Aaron. So the first two films are about food. That's very interesting, changing people's behavior. 866-893-KPCC. We should mention Morgan Spurlock because that's sort of, and I don't mean this disparagingly, but sort of stunt documentary where the director puts him or herself through some life-altering experience, like he ate McDonald's for, I don't remember how long it was.
A month.
That's all he ate. But that gave rise to a whole slew of those kind of films.
I feel like it's an extreme extension of what Michael Moore was doing, right? Because Michael Moore was very much front and center in his storytelling. He's not letting the talking heads do it. He's part of it. And Morgan Spurlock takes that to a physical extreme.
Let's go back to Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore's 2002 documentary, when that film was trying to make a point about the easy purchase of handguns.
I'd spotted an ad in the local Michigan paper that said if you opened an account at North Country Bank, the bank would give you a gun.
You do a CD and we'll hand you a gun. We have a whole brochure here that you can look at.
Mm-hmm.
Once we do the background check and everything,
it's
yours to go.
Okay. All right, well, that's the account I'd like to open.
We have a vault, which at all times we keep at least 500 firearms.
500 of these you have in your vault?
In our vault.
Wow.
We have to do a background check.
At the bank here? Or?
At the bank, which we are a licensed firearm dealer.
Oh, you are? Mm-hmm. You're a bank and a licensed firearm dealer.
Certainly convenient. Bowling for Columbine from 2002. John, who for you were some of the folk? I mean, we talked about Michael Moore and Spurlock, Morgan Spurlock, others who their films represented a kind of a breakthrough.
Well, I think that maybe I'll betray some of my age, but a filmmaker that I greatly admire is Fred Wiseman. And his films are very difficult. And but I think really engage the viewer in a way that a lot of films don't, because he doesn't take the fictional arc many times that people now demand from documentaries. It has to have a kind of an arc that you'd see in a fiction film. To go back to the film about the climbing a cup of 10, his name just slipped my mind.
Freestyle.
Sorry, we all jumped on it.
What intrigued me about that, aside from being spectacular photography and a very dramatic story, is the open admission of the fact of the role of the filmmaking process in this. The filmmakers actually question whether their presence are spurring him on to do something that could kill him or be dangerous. Also, the fact that they're on the edge of the wall of rock with him physically might interfere with the climb itself. That's a critical aspect of what you need to do when you're thinking about documentarians. They are not separate beings. You are engaging with the people you're in. You're engaging with the environment you're in. And talking about Spurlock, I mean, probably the master of that kind of early kind of film, which is different in many ways, is Ross McElwee.
I was just going to tout him. I was actually looking up the title of his film.
Sherman's March.
Sherman's March. Very personal.
And, you know, either he drives you crazy or intrigues you. And basically he walks around with a camera on his shoulder. And in Sherman's March, it's about his relationship with Southern women. He's from the South himself. It's a kind of a droll narration. But it's a kind of a personal approach. There's a whole style. I talk about this in the book, the whole style of personal documentary filmmaking that goes back not just to McElwee. You can trace it back to the early days of home movies. And there's a filmmaker who made more than 100 home movies, and there were the adventures of his family. and they were not screened in theaters. This is before television.
This is pre-reality. It sounds like reality TV.
And yet you learn a lot by looking at this. So a lot of one of the things about this book that I really made a great effort to do is to go beyond the traditional boundaries of what documentaries are. I talk about educational films. I talk about promotional films. I talk about short subjects that were in theaters. I talk about home movies. Basically, my feeling is that films that claim to portray some aspect of the real world are important. But even more important, what were the films that viewers considered to be true? A filmmaker might say, oh, no, well, it's reality TV. Of course it's not true. If an audience believes it's true, it has effect. And so you need to take that into account when you're evaluating films. So one of the things I say, we're in this golden age of documentary filmmaking. At the same time, truth has never been more under assault than ever. And that was the primary reason I wrote this book.
The book is Screening Reality, How Documentary Filmmakers Reimagined America. John Wilkman with us. Let me share some listener contributions. Joe in Redondo Beach says, an inconvenient truth changed my life to the point I switched careers from being a corporate creative consultant to being a climate activist in Los Angeles. Sean in Studio City said, John O'Hagan's Wonderland, a documentary about people who lived in a planned community for GIs returning from World War II. A beautiful portrait of those everyday people with ordinary stories. It was so mundane, but lyrical. And Mark in Costa Mesa says, The 20th Century by Walter Cronkite, the series you did, John, I was 8 at the time, and the program was on the Holocaust, Mark says, made a tremendous impact on me when I saw showers at Auschwitz and telling stories of hurting young children, the visuals of shoes and teeth. Mark, thank you so much. John, good to have you with us again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Screening Reality, the book. Also, Christy Lemire joining us on the program, and Lael Lowenstein, thank you so much as well. All right, stay tuned to 89.3 KPCC Saturday afternoon, 2 to 4, NPR live coverage of the Nevada Democratic caucuses. Have a great weekend.